Hi, everyone. We are thrilled to have Glass Health as our sponsor. Let's hear from Derek Paul, the co-founder and CEO of Glass Health, which is a platform that empowers clinicians with the best-in-class AI for clinical decision support.
At Glass, one of the things we're most excited about is trying to help the provider navigate clinical information and clinical literature to draft assessment and plan. So actually going and navigating an article that would be similar to an up-to-date article that has the peer-reviewed clinical guidelines and for the large language model to say, okay, next steps are to order this test to advance our understanding of this problem diagnostically, or here's the standard of care treatment. And I think what's important in all of this is that the healthcare provider is still very much in the driver's seat and very much supervising the large language model in the way that you might supervise a medical student. You're sort of in an edit and a test mode, but I think that's going to have huge benefits on efficiency.
And we will link to that assessment and plan feature in the show notes. Good news is that you can get 1 month free access to Glass Pro using the promo code CoreIM. We'll link it in our show notes. And with that, let's get into the episode. And as a bonus, if you have Glass Pro and share your code, you and a friend can get an additional 30 days free.
You have to think a little bit like a bone marrow transplant doctor, and they have learned an amazing instinct for how inflammation and irritation results in misbehavior of the transplanted immune system. So you have to have a little bit of paranoia, and you have to look for subtle things when dealing with checkpoint inhibitors and when dealing with the immune system. Anytime there's something on a scan that doesn't make sense, you kind of need to explain it. And anytime someone doesn't get better, you kind of need to explain it.
That's Dr. Benjamin Schlechter, a GI oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Welcome to the CoreIM Thigh Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. This is Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by
Dr. Anuranita, or Anu Gupta, an internal medicine resident at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Today, we're doing part two of our podcast on immune checkpoint inhibitors and immune-related adverse events, or IRAs.
Yeah, you're going to hear Anu and me say IRAs a lot, which takes a second to get used to. But if you're not an oncologist, just remember IRAs means immune checkpoint inhibitor adverse events, or sometimes we'll say checkpoint inhibitor toxicity. So yeah, in the first episode, we tried to lay a really good foundation of how these checkpoint inhibitors work, and then a framework to think about all the different adverse events that can happen.
In this episode, we're zeroing in on our illness scripts to differentiate IRAs from other medical conditions. And we'll share some crucial management tips too.
Yeah. And we really honed in on the solid organs that are the most common. And I will say it was a pretty hard job to pick our discussants' brain and really press them on kind of what are the important differentiators. And hopefully this helps us feel a little bit less lost when we're thinking about is it one thing or some of the more common things that affects the organ.
With each of these solid organs, we will touch on symptoms, diagnosis, and management. Let's get started with the pearls we'll be covering.
Test yourself by pausing after each of the five questions. Remember, the more you test yourselves, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, pneumonitis or inflammation of the lung parenchyma.
How do we diagnose checkpoint inhibitor-related pneumonitis? And once it's identified, how do we treat it?
Pearl 2, colitis or inflammation of the colon.
What do we typically see on CAT scans for checkpoint inhibitor-related colitis, and how do we treat it based on symptoms?
Pearl 3, skin IRAs.
What are the important things to pay attention to in the history and exam for dermatological adverse events that we might see? And again, how's this treated?
Pearl 4, endocrine IRAs, with a focus on thyroid adverse events.
With checkpoint inhibitor toxicity related to the thyroid, what are the different presentations, and at what TSH level do you stop the checkpoint inhibitor?
Pearl 5, endocrine IRAs continued, with a focus on hypophysitis or pituitary inflammation.
How does hypophysitis present, and do steroids help? All right, let's start with a case we all have seen not too infrequently.
Mr. Johnson is a 64-year-old male with history of HFpEF and stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer diagnosed 2 years ago. He has been receiving atezolizumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, as part of his treatment plan for the past 5 months. He presents to clinic with dry cough and shortness of breath for the past 4 weeks. On exam, he's sitting 93% on room air, and crackles are heard in the lower lung fields.
This case has just so much to dig into, right? This presentation could be heart failure, it could be PE, could be infection, it could be pneumonitis from his radiotherapy, it could be lymphatic spread of malignancy, right? So, Anu, are there any specific characteristics of the checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis that we should be looking out for and can help tease things apart?
So pneumonitis, like all of the IRAs, can present at any time. But the general rule of thumb is that pneumonitis is about 8 months after starting the checkpoint inhibitor.
Okay, so he's like past 5 months, so not as much of a slam dunk. But if we move on to like the symptoms, I imagine the symptoms aren't too specific to help us differentiate pneumonitis IRA versus something else.
You're right. So someone can come in with acute hypoxic respiratory failure or have cough, dyspnea, chest pain. What's crazy is that some people are even asymptomatic.
Wild. So we sat down with Dr. Warner, a melanoma oncologist at Stanford, who gave a pro tip about what we typically see when we check an ambulatory O2 set of someone who has pneumonitis related to their checkpoint inhibitor.
One thing that I have found to be exceptionally useful is an ambulatory set. So sometimes patients are sitting very well and appropriately on room air at rest. And just like the old days of PCP, their oxygenation will plummet with any exercise. So I found that to be very helpful and obviously is a test you can easily do in your office and that can be useful.
All right. Yes, I will be on the lookout for the ambulatory sat to straight plummet. All right. So say we want to do a diagnostic workup for these pulmonary symptoms that Mr. Johnson has. What would you send off?
Okay. So the approach here is to really rule out the common things that we have good tests for. So I'd want to do an infectious workup for sure. A sputum culture, respiratory viral panel, COVID-19, blood cultures, and I'd even consider urine legionella and strep pneumoantigen. I would also throw in a BNP given his history of heart failure. And then for imaging, I would think about chest x-ray, but I'd probably delete that order and order a CT chest with contrast, both to rule out pulmonary embolism and see what the lung parenchyma looks like.
Nice. And that's exactly what Dr. Nerges Flores, a thoracic oncologist at Dana-Farber, recommended when we sat down with her.
So no chest x-ray. In this case, we skip that. CT chest. And how the inflammation pattern will help you understand. If it's a diffuse ground glass, a diffuse infiltrase in both lobes, that's a drug-induced pneumonitis.
And from my reading, there are actually 5 different radiographic subtypes that we see with pneumonitis. Ground glass opacities in the lower lobes are the most common subtype of pneumonitis.
Now, in this day and age, you're usually told inflammatory process in the lungs, ground glass opacities, you know, septal thickening, pneumonitis versus drug toxicity cannot rule out COVID-19. And that will be the scan result that you get 100% of the time.
I just appreciate his realness, right? That we can't hang our hats on the CT scan to give us kind of the slam dunk answer.
It can be harder on a CT as well for lung cancer patients because their baseline lung parenchyma isn't often normal. Right. Whereas a melanoma patient often has normal baseline lung parenchyma. Additionally, then you add the complication of radiation. And we occasionally radiate lung lesions in melanoma as well. And we are all sitting there pulling our hair out, trying to figure out what is happening.
Okay. It does feel really validating to hear these oncologists say that they might be pulling their hair out too. But, you know, if we're still unsure from all the workup that we sent off for Mr. Johnson's symptoms and not sure if it's infection, cancer, pneumonitis, everything's still kind of on deck, could we then use a bronchoscopy to help us kind of sway us one way or the other?
Oh, you may have opened up a can of worms here, Shreya. It turns out that the role of bronchoscopy is widely debated in the field.
You do, you know, sputum samples, maybe even a BAL from a bronch. It comes back non-infectious, but it can come back non-infectious frequently, even with pneumonia, because the sensitivity of that test isn't great. You know, often they've already gotten antibiotics before you've gotten the BAL, and so it may be sterile, but there's still infection there that you are already treating.
So yeah, the bronch might not give you a clear-cut answer. But of course, if the BAL does pick up on an infection, that can be helpful. Also, if the transbronchial biopsy does show cancer, that can be helpful too.
Oof, okay. So it sounds like the bronch can be another thing that can be helpful if something comes back positive, but may not be that helpful. So let me just close up this can of worms, get back to Mr. Johnson. Say oncology sees him, none of the other workup has come back positive, and in thinking of the clinical picture, does say, yeah, pneumonitis from a checkpoint inhibitor makes sense. And with oncology's blessings, they say, let's treat him.
So the big picture here is that the treatment of these toxicities is generally guided by what grade, aka what severity they are. And there are usually four grades, with four being the worst.
Yeah, and the ASCO guidelines here are really great. They lay everything out so clearly in terms of for each of these organs, what is considered grade one to four based on the severity and what the exact management doses of things are. And we'll link that in the show notes for you all to check out.
Yeah, the higher grades often reflect a higher severity of symptoms and a larger amount of lung parenchyma affected. The lack of response to treatment of a lower grade can also upgrade it to a higher grade.
Yeah, that's good to know. And then just to contextualize this, the how severe things can be, someone who's a grade three is someone who's typically coming into the hospital for severe symptoms, may have a new oxygen requirement, or has all their lungs or greater than 50% of the parenchyma affected.
And what most internists here are thinking about are, you know, do we hold the checkpoint inhibitor temporarily or permanently?
This is what I think is a very good take-home message is if you identify these immune relay adverse events early, it allows for the patient to maybe re-challenge in the future. Because if you identify as a grade one or grade two, you can re-challenge. But if it's a grade three or grade four, that's a no-no.
Of course, all of the management plans involve steroids in different types and doses. Pneumonitis is no exception here. For the highest grade, oncologists consider treating with immunomodulators. There's infliximab, mycophenolate, IVIG, and cyclophosphamide.
Right. And one helpful thing that I found is a trajectory of pneumonitis from checkpoint inhibitors. The cool thing is that with steroids, the patient should start feeling better almost like right away, especially with the lower grades, maybe even within a day.
But the difference between the COPD exacerbation and the pneumonitis is that they get like a Lazarus effect. You start the patient on prednisone, and next day you called in and like, doctor, I'm doing great. Doing great. So you don't get that with COPD. It takes a little bit longer.
Great. Okay. Then like, what about the humble diuretics and the antibiotics that they got earlier in the admission? You know, it's hard to say, was it that or was it the steroids sometimes? I'm just curious overall, is there a role for diuretics, antibiotics in the management plan?
Truthfully, a lot of these cases are not clear pneumonitis, and it's not easy to rule out infection and volume overload. You end up doing a bunch of things together, like steroids, antibiotics, and diuretics.
You know, we had a patient I remember clearly was starting to escalate to even needing high flow and was not responding to antibiotics, did have a fever, which was leading us more towards the infection pathway. But inflammation can also cause fevers. You know, we had a multidisciplinary conference. If we are letting pneumonitis fester without steroids, we are, you know, very much, you know, potentially getting into a very dangerous territory where patients can need to be intubated. And so, you know, there was a lot of concern, obviously, about giving steroids and lowering responsiveness to infection if this did happen to be infectious. And, you know, our infectious disease colleagues were certainly concerned about that, as was I. But at the end of the day, we really felt strongly that there was a very good chance this was also pneumonitis that was going untreated and that the patient was deteriorating. And so we did. We put them on, you know, HCAP level antibiotics as well as, you know, full dose steroids. And thankfully, that patient, I don't know which one they got better in response to. Maybe it was both, you know, but that patient did thankfully turn around.
I appreciate ending this pearl on pneumonitis, reflecting on just the humbling nature of medicine and how we have to work with our colleagues to figure out, are we doing too little, too much, and kind of really welcome the difference of practice patterns, especially in these grayer areas. So with that, Anu, why don't we recap some of the big takeaways? What do you want people to take away from this pearl?
What I really want people to remember is that the presentation for pneumonitis is nonspecific, but there are some clues. For example, it presenting around 8 months since starting the medication and also having a CAT scan with ground glass opacities in the lower lobes. If it is checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis, then the treatment, steroids, will make the patient feel better very soon, especially at the lower grades.
Okay, now that we did pneumonitis, let's move down a little bit lower in the body to colitis. And I think this is, again, another tricky one because a lot of the symptoms are nonspecific and can mimic other conditions. So Anu, can you give us a case to kind of help to ground us, and then we can pick our expert's brain on what we can and can't hang our hats on?
Yeah, let's jump right in. Miss Moon has a history of stage 4 metastatic melanoma, which was diagnosed a year ago and has been undergoing treatment for the past 2 months with nivolumab and ipilimumab. So that's a combination of PD-1 and CTLA-4 inhibitor. She presents to the hospital with acute abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea with 8 stools per day. She also can't tolerate any oral intake.
Ugh, I feel so bad for her. What to do? For some spaced repetition from our first episode on the IRAs, we learned that the median onset is around 8 weeks after the immune checkpoint inhibitor starts. So that fits pretty nicely with Ms. Moon's case, right? 2 months later.
Yeah. And like most IRAs, the combination checkpoint inhibitors are the most likely to cause toxicity.
Yeah. And she's on that combo. And then in terms of symptoms, right? Colitis IRA, you can expect anywhere from few GI symptoms to a lot.
It's usually a subacute onset over 3 or 4 days, on these 2 or 3 days where they get kind of like watery stool, increased frequency, feel a little bit off.
When thinking about diarrhea, other than the usual culprits that you already think of, don't forget radiation colitis. There's also graft versus host disease, which doesn't apply to this patient, but it does apply to certain bone marrow transplant patients. And then there's also other drug effects like chemotherapy or tyrosine kinase inhibitor.
And remind me what the tyrosine kinase inhibitors are again.
Okay, so if you're looking at a list of cancer therapies and you see TNIB at the end of the name, there's a good chance that it's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor.
Oh, I like the T from tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and then you can think about a T in TNIB. I like when something kind of makes sense. All right, why don't we go back then to the drawing board. We're admitting Ms. Moon to the hospital. What kind of diagnostic workup will be the most helpful to help tease things apart?
You should check for common things like C. diff, norovirus.
Yeah, in addition to C. diff and norovirus, I would get TSH, stool cultures, ova, and parasites. For particularly immunocompromised patients, I would add on the good old CMV, cryptosporidium, microsporidium, and cyclospora tests.
Yeah, that's a pretty good infectious workup. And then we also have these like fecal inflammatory markers like fecal calprotectin or lactoferrin.
Mm-hmm. These inflammatory markers can represent the amount of mucosal damage that there has been.
Yeah. So I wonder if we can then use it to monitor how much mucosal damage there is over time.
Yep. And fun fact, if it is the checkpoint inhibitor colitis, then the oncologist will monitor the fecal calprotectin to see if they can restart the checkpoint inhibitor.
Cool.
If the level is below 116, that might be the green light that they're looking for.
Okay, so it sounds like below a certain level, we know the inflammation has cooled down, there's less mucosal damage.
One thing to keep in mind is that if your patient has a GI malignancy, lactoferrin and fecal calprotectin might be higher than normal anyway, even without the colitis.
Yeah, and some of these can be, the inflammatory markers can be high in any type of colitis too. So it's, again, it's not something we can hang our hats on.
A flex sig with tissue biopsy will be diagnostic, although that's not a nice thing to do to someone who's got an inflamed colon and diarrhea.
Yeah, though I hear like the EGD and or colonoscopy, if we see signs for ulceration, that can help us know a little bit early if we need to reach for a biologic agent or not. But yeah, I never know when to pull the trigger to consult or not to get that scope.
I'm team GI consult. The decision to scope is complex, and it's definitely worth the multidisciplinary discussion. In general, if symptoms are mild, it might be reasonable to wait for the inflammation to cool down before scoping. But if the inflammation is severe, it is recommended to scope early.
What about the med rec then? What should we be thinking about or asking our patients about if we're thinking about checkpoint inhibitor toxicity colitis?
Well, I would ask about antibiotics with C. diff in mind, and I would also ask about NSAID use and prolonged PPI use since they've been linked with checkpoint inhibitor colitis.
Yes, all good things. Okay. And then in terms of imaging, there's a CT abdomen pelvis with without contrast, and that's going to help us ask, what's the extent of the colitis? Is there an abscess or not? And then, of course, you know, I think what I've learned the hard way is patients can have two things going on. I recently took over a patient whose CAT scan was pretty prominent for, you know, pointing to diverticulitis. So our team first just treated with that. But it turned out that the patient did have both diverticulitis and checkpoint inhibitor colitis, but it took us a while to figure that out.
I think it's very legitimate if a patient presents with diverticulitis on a checkpoint inhibitor to treat them for diverticulitis. You're not risking anything by doing that. But be worried that either there's something else going on or something else could go on. And just think about it. You should hear that whisper in the back of your mind. Well, what about the Pembro?
We love a good auditory hallucination. And what a great opportunity to talk about CT findings in colitis, IRA. I can't imagine a radiology read explicitly identifying a checkpoint inhibitor colitis, but some clues to look out for is that it often affects the descending colon. Other buzzwords are mesenteric vessel engorgement, bowel wall thickening, and fluid-filled colon distension.
Let's look at the wall of the colon. Something that's very unique to colitis induced by immunotherapy is they have wall edema, and you can see that. In diverticulitis, you see the pouches that are inflamed, but they're individual. But here is a continuous wall edema, and it's a malabsorption diarrhea. That's what it is. It's like Crohn induced by drugs. So it's a malabsorption diarrhea. And the patient, we told you, very different than the diverticulitis diarrhea. Is how did they say it in their own words? Everything just goes through me. That's a very common phrase. Everything just goes through me. Because the wall has so much edema. That's why the physiology of medicine is so beautiful. The wall has so much edema because there's T cell infiltration that produces this humongous amount of inflammation. So there is no way that there is any villi able to absorb anything.
That physiology is so beautiful, and it really just makes me want to pay more attention to the history that someone's giving and see that CT scan to see if I see that significant wall edema. All right, now with all that, why don't we move on to treatment? And I'm sure here, again, the management depends on the grades or the severity.
For the grades, it's all about the number of stools. Less than 4 stools a day, you do the typical supportive management with hydration, medications like loperamide once you've ruled out C. diff, or blood in the bowel movements. And you can continue or temporarily hold the checkpoint inhibitor until symptoms resolve.
So speaking of which, to hold or not to hold the immune checkpoint inhibitor always stresses me out. And some days I find myself scrambling to get a hold of the oncologist depending on what day or time of the day the patient comes in. And I'm just wondering, is it okay or not for the patient to miss a dose?
There is no such thing as urgent checkpoint inhibitors, okay? These are drugs whose onsets are in weeks to months. If you give someone a highly active chemotherapy, you could see benefit on a chemosensitive cancer in days. If you give people a highly active checkpoint inhibitor on a highly immune responsive cancer, you don't see anything for weeks. There is no situation in which giving a checkpoint inhibitor is an emergency. And that's also an important utilization discussion. Okay. Sometimes should we give this person inpatient checkpoint inhibitors? No, we should not. These drugs have an incredibly long half-life, usually over 20 days. Missing a dose is fine, but it's very hard to reassure patients about that. And even doctors, I'll be honest, I always want to order it when they're in the hospital, but you got to step back and be logical, and missing a dose is okay.
Okay. That's helpful. We can rest assured on that front. And then Anu, what if our patient is having a higher grade severity colitis? What if they have more than 4 stools a day above their baseline? What's the management that we're thinking about there?
Yep, for the higher grades, aka more than 4 stools above baseline, we are, of course, going to reach for steroids, prednisone versus methylpred. We're also going to taper over 4 to 6 weeks once symptoms improve.
Wow, that taper is pretty long, over a month or so. Why so long?
There are some patients who can do with a quick taper, but many will have their colitis flare again if you taper too quickly. So this isn't a set it and forget it type of taper, because as soon as the colitis flares again, or whatever ICI or IRAE you're treating, you have to go back up. This is an individual patient approach.
I had a patient just like this, and I remember the Core IM steroids episode. I pulled up the graphic to remind myself about PJP prophylaxis, osteoporosis prophylaxis, as well as GI prophylaxis with the PPI.
Nice. That is such a great connection and a really good throwback in terms of prophylaxis. So I guess on that front, we talked about when we give steroids. I'm curious, when is a colitis bad enough that we might reach for biologic agents?
If the symptoms don't improve in 3 days of steroids, it's time to pull out the big gun biologics. For colitis, this includes anti-TNF agents like infliximab and anti-integrin agents like vedolizumab.
Okay, that's good to know that it's, you know, that three-day mark when we're looking for backup help and knowing maybe steroids are not going to be enough to do the trick. Okay, so that was a whirlwind. Why don't we recap colitis related to checkpoint inhibitors? I think what I've learned is that the typical presentation for IRA colitis is typically 2 months since starting the checkpoint inhibitor, and it's really going to be a presentation of voluminous, numerous episodes of diarrhea. And when we're working it up, we're thinking about ruling out infectious causes. We're going to look for imaging and see if we see that significant wall edema. And I think a good nugget on management to take away is that it's okay to hold the immune checkpoint inhibitor, but we're trying to tease out if it's IRA colitis or not. And then if it's a lower grade, less than 4 stools above baseline, we can get away with some supportive management. But if it's more than that, then yes, we are going to reach for steroids. Now on to the skin.
Yeah, with my sunscreen in hand, I'm ready to talk about our next case, Drea. So this is Ms. Singh, who has a history of stage 3 melanoma and was recently started on adjuvant nivolumab, a PD-1 inhibitor. She presents to clinic with a rash that developed over the past week. Exam shows erythematous macules over the chest, which are pruritic with no vesicles.
It's red, macular, papular. I'm not going to try to describe that anymore because every time an internist describes a rash, a dermatologist tears a little bit of blood somewhere. So I'm just going to call it erythematous macropapular rash that's pruritic. It's as much as you get from me.
Yes, I appreciate all our oncologists bringing like their honest selves in terms of these checkpoint inhibitors. But yes, we've all been there in looking at a rash. And a good throwback to our last episode is that we know that the skin toxicity that we might see happens relatively early on in the picture, right? If you look at the literature, the median time is around 7 weeks or so. But honestly, all our oncologists told us stories that they've often seen it, you know, pretty soon after starting the checkpoint inhibitor, especially even like 3 weeks out, like our patient.
Yeah. And then the symptoms here can vary a bunch. Some patients just have an itch, plus minus a rash, but some can have scarier symptoms like fever, skin sloughing, pustules, blisters, mucosal erosions.
So first of all, make sure it's a rash and make sure it's not itching that they scratched, that it's a rash. The next thing you want to do is look at how extensive it is. Look at the body. You really have to undress the patient and see how extensive it is and use your BSA calculations to figure out how much of the body is covered. And then critically, you must look in the mouth. If there is a skin toxicity in the mouth, you need to call for help.
Yeah, especially the scarier stuff like bullae, if we're concerned about bullous dermatosis, vitiligo, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, or DRESS, of course we're going to loop in our friendly local dermatologist. But for the rest of the pearl, let's talk about the common skin toxicity, inflammatory dermatitis.
You want to ask all the typical dermatology questions, right? Any new exposures, any new foods? Did you change your detergent?
Yep, we're going to ask all those good derm questions. And of course, as an internist, right, one of our favorites is thinking about any recent medications or over-the-counter meds.
Yep, all this good history can help us rule out an allergic or contact dermatitis, as well as eczema.
And then doing a good exam can help us rule out some of the more infectious dermatitis, right? Like thinking about fungi with tinea, bacteria with impetigo, or a virus like with shingles. So yeah, there's just a lot on the differential when it comes to skin stuff.
Okay, Shreya, I have to share this one fact about vitiligo that I learned while researching this topic that was so interesting to me.
Yeah, go for it.
So apparently vitiligo, which as a quick reminder is the loss of skin color in patches, hints at a stronger immune response of the drug against melanoma. So basically, if you see vitiligo as a toxicity, it means that the checkpoint inhibitor is kicking the melanoma's butt.
Ah, amazing. So like on one hand, you're like, oh, I'm so sorry. You're having, you know, these patches of skin color loss. And then on the other hand, you're like, yay, we're getting rid of cancer cells. So what a humbling reminder of the yin and yang of life. All right. So I'm then curious, what are the specific grades and management tips here to help us out with the skin IRAs? You know, honestly, if I try to force myself, all I can think about is we got to call derm.
Your index of suspicion has to be that this is ICI. Dermatitis from ICI is exceptionally common and can happen quite early, even after the first dose. There is very little harm in giving topical steroids.
if this is on a, you know, a small enough area of the body that you can use topical steroids, I always prefer that to systemic steroids. I don't necessarily biopsy these patients and get dermatologic biopsies unless it appears very abnormal. It doesn't respond to typical treatments. Then I certainly, you know, pull in my dermatology colleagues.
So for low grades in skin toxicity, that is less than 10% of body surface area with no systemic symptoms, treatment usually involves emollients, aka moisturizing treatments, as well as topical steroids. Here we can continue the checkpoint inhibitor.
Yeah, and just like the lung and the GI tracts, what we saw with the higher grades is we're often reaching for steroids and holding the checkpoint inhibitor. Okay, so then with Ms. Singh, she had a grade 1 maculopapular eruption, so we treated with topical steroids, and maybe we avoided the dermatology consult, or maybe we just did because we were scared. But just to say it out loud, when should we be referring to derm?
Generally, refer to dermatology at grade 3 or higher, which is usually greater than 30% of body surface area. But if there is any concern at all for Stevens-Johnson syndrome, DRESS, or mucous membrane involvement, please refer to dermatology at any grade.
Okay, nice. So let me try to recap all that we are taking away with skin toxicity from an immune checkpoint inhibitor. I think it's really important, again, to take a really good history about exposure, meds, do a good exam to rule out infection, look at mucous membranes, look out for blisters, really trying to think about the body surface area. Since the ASCO guidelines, you'll see it's all about kind of the percentage body surface area that's affected that leads to management. Thankfully, if it's less than 10% of the body surface area affected, we can often get away with topical steroids. If not, we're going to be reaching for more systemic steroids. All right, so Pearl 4, we are diving all into the glands or the endocrine checkpoint inhibitor toxicities. This Pearl, we're going to focus on the thyroid, and in the last Pearl, we're going to wrap up with the pituitary gland.
Okay, let's get to our case. Okay, picture Mr. Williams, who is a 58-year-old man with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer, who has been receiving treatment with pembrolizumab starting 5 months ago. Just a few weeks prior, he felt very hot most of the time and was having frequent bowel movements. But now he reports he's had recent weight gain, he goes a few days without bowel movements, and he feels cold despite the weather being warm.
So his case does fit pretty nicely with what we talked about in our last episode, that typically one typical presentation of thyroid issues from checkpoint inhibitor is that they're hyperthyroid first and then become hypothyroid.
Yep. So first there's a transient subacute thyroiditis, which increases the release of thyroid hormone. That caused him to have heat intolerance and diarrhea. But later the gland burns out. And so he became hypothyroid with cold intolerance, constipation, and weight gain.
And Dr. Flores laid out just how closely she follows a patient watching for that transition point, right, between the hyperthyroid to the hypothyroid state.
First dose of Pembro, nothing happens. Second dose of Pembro, TSH comes to 0.01. And then you're like, let me get the T4. So the T4 is elevated. And you're like, well, you're in thyroiditis now. You have to let you cool down. But you don't treat it, at least the patient is symptomatic. If the patient is symptomatic in the thyroiditis phase, you do have to do propranolol. You do have to do the inhibition. But then we have very close follow-up. At that point, I do call my endocrinologist because there's a very fine line when the patient is hyperthyroid and then become hypothyroid.
Yeah, it's like a balancing seesaw, right? We do have these drugs that are disposable to treat symptomatic hyperthyroidism with propranolol. But we're also monitoring very closely for that progression of that thyroid gland getting burnt out.
Totally. And going back to our case with Mr. Williams, if I had to create a differential diagnosis from his current symptoms in line with primary hypothyroidism, I would include Hashimoto's thyroiditis, a post-viral subacute thyroiditis, and I would think about other drugs like lithium, amiodarone, and antiepileptics that could be contributing.
Yeah, and then I think in terms of the cancer population, we're also thinking about, is there a history of head and neck radiation? Could central hypothyroidism be playing a factor? And we're going to get into that a little bit more with the pituitary in the next Pearl.
What's really interesting about the endocrine glands is that giving steroids like we do for the solid organs and the skin IRAs doesn't really resolve the toxicity.
The thing that's different about endocrinopathies is that they tend to be permanent.
that once whatever gland is affected, it tends to stop making their hormone, even if you aggressively treat the inflammation.
Well, that's really unfortunate, right? Like glands can't bounce back the way solid organs do, but it sounds like our patients will do just fine as long as they're getting some hormone replacement.
But the exception to being on hormone replacement is if it's grade 1 thyroid toxicity, and grade 1 means asymptomatic with minimal TSH elevation, you would continue the ICI and monitor TSH.
So that's straightforward if it's a lower grade toxicity. But if it's grade 2 or higher, which is going to be a TSH greater than 10 million international units per liter, and if the patient's symptomatic, we're generally holding the checkpoint inhibitor for grade 2 or higher, and then also reaching for levothyroxine at this point.
Part of the monitoring here is checking both TSH and T4 levels. The free T4 usually normalizes sooner than the TSH, so it's better to check both at once.
Yeah, and then once that TSH and T4 do reach normal ranges, of course, we're continuing to leave with our oxygen, right? The gland usually doesn't bounce back unless it's like a grade one. And then we're also checking thyroid function tests every 6 months to a year or so.
And that's a wrap on thyroid IRAs. Let's recap this pearl. Thyroid IRA usually presents as a transient hyperthyroid state followed by a hypothyroid one.
Yeah. And then for management, again, the ASCO guidelines lays all this out really nicely. We're going to link all this in our show notes. But I think big picture takeaway is that the thyroid gland being affected is often permanent. And so giving steroids won't resolve it. And ultimately, these patients are going to need hormone replacement with levothyroxine.
Now onto the pituitary gland and its IRA, which is called hypophysitis.
Ugh. Hypophysitis, like why do they call it that? Like couldn't it be pituitaryitis?
That would be too easy, Shreya. That would be way too easy.
Yeah, right? It takes me a second to link hypophysitis to the pituitary, but okay. All right, let's solidify this a little bit more with a case on hypophysitis.
This one is about Ms. Thompson, a 59-year-old female with stage 4 renal cell carcinoma who was treated with ipilimumab and nivolumab, CTLA-4 and PD-1 inhibitors, 1.5 years ago. She now presents to the hospital with fatigue, headache, nausea, vomiting. And over the last week, she experienced episodes of dizziness.
So when I see a patient in clinic with kind of the dwindles, they're just not right. Their electrolytes are a little bit off. They've got the like hyperkalemic, you know, metabolic acidosis-y, kind of like funny, something's wrong. They often are hyponatremic, so they're not eating well. They're kind of weak and dizzy. We worry about endocrinopathy.
All right. So the pituitary just has so many different hormones, right? Patients can present with so many different symptoms and different conditions, and often they're pretty vague. Like here, I'm thinking about adrenal insufficiency. Ms. Thompson has these like vague fatigue, nausea, vomiting, dizziness.
So true. And you know, Shreya, when I'm thinking about the hormone axes and specifically the pituitary gland, I always think back to learning the flat pig mnemonic in med school.
I don't remember learning that in med school. So please review for me.
So the anterior pituitary hormones are FSH, LH, ACTH, TSH, prolactin, and growth hormone. And there's the posterior pituitary too that makes oxytocin and ADH.
Hypophysitis, not the most common, definitely the most dramatic. They often have like that tunnel vision thing you learn about in doctor school, where like they bounce off the door frame, and they have like, when you ask them, they will say like, oh yeah, it's so weird. I keep hitting my shoulder on the door. I had a patient who worked at Home Depot, and he's like, I kept bumping into the racks.
Oh man. Yeah. We definitely have to ask good questions and also listen really well to see if visual changes may be contributing to various kind of stories we might hear, right? Because this could mean that the optic nerve is being affected from actual physical compression.
Definitely. So what's the diagnostic workup that we're getting for Ms. Thompson and these vague symptoms if we're concerned about hypophysitis?
So you're going to check your TSH and your free T4 because you might, you know, have high in the axis thyroid dysfunction. You want to check your ACTH. I check prolactin because sometimes prolactin is actually really high or really low, maybe you know, and cortisol, random cortisol and amcortisol. And if you see evidence of this sort of panhypopit presentation, it's probably hypophysitis.
Okay. And then we can also send off an LH, FSH, estrogen, testosterone. But if there aren't overt symptoms of hormone imbalance with these, we don't have to send them.
You can often prove it with an MRI with a pituitary protocol, but you can also prove it by labs. And that's probably faster than getting an MRI in a lot of cases.
And that's an MRI brain with and without contrast with cellular cuts. You're especially going to want to get this if there are red flags for visual changes.
Early hypophysitis, so brand new imaging, you know, you can actually see on a dedicated brain MRI, you have to get thin cuts through the pituitary. If there is acute inflammation that you've caught early, there is a thought that pulse dose steroids might be able to rescue some of those patients to maintain some endocrine function.
Okay, so not to bury the lead here, her labs show that TSH and FREE24 are normal. We covered that in Pearl 4, so we're good. But her AM cortisol comes back at 1.2 micrograms per deciliter and also has a low ACTH. So both AM cortisol and ACTH are low, which suggests something higher up, a central process, right? Rather than something just at the level of the adrenal gland that would be primary adrenal insufficiency.
And then unsurprisingly, her MRI showed pituitary enlargement with inflammation.
So now that we know that we're dealing with hypophysitis, let's talk about management. And I'm sure here, management and the grading can be a bit subjective, depends on really the severity of symptoms and kind of how a patient might describe it.
That's true. But the difference here is that treatment really depends on which hormone axes have been hit.
Yeah. So for example, you know, we had just talked about giving levothyroxine if we need thyroid replacement, or if the sex hormones have been affected, you know, giving testosterone, estrogen, especially if there's no contraindications with prostate or breast cancer.
But in our patient, we know that the adrenal axis was hit. So we could give hydrocortisone or prednisone for secondary adrenal insufficiency. And again, it's secondary because it's affecting the pituitary gland, not the adrenal gland.
Yep. And if there are vision changes from the optic chiasm being compressed from pituitary swelling, then we would certainly reach for higher dose steroids and taper over weeks to a maintenance therapy dose.
All right. So let's recap what I think are the most salient pearls on hypophysitis. It can present with a wide range of symptoms given all the hormones affected by the gland. In addition to evaluating the hormone levels, headache and visual changes are important things to look out for because they're going to prompt you to get MRI imaging of the pituitary gland.
Yep, and then once hypophysitis is identified, hormone replacement therapy is really the major part of the treatment. But if the optic nerve is compressed and there's pituitary swelling, we're going to reach for more potent steroids to really preserve vision.
And that wraps up our clinical pearls on immune checkpoint inhibitor adverse events.
If you found this episode helpful, please share it with your team, your colleagues, give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
This episode was made as part of the digital education track at BIDMC. Thank you to all the educators and mentors. And thank you to our peer reviewers, Dr. Meng Wu and Dr. Sharon Illad.
Thank you to Jerome Reyes for audio editing, as well as Dr. Kathy Sasson for the accompanying graphic. And if you want to learn more and check out the behind-the-scenes interviews that Anu and I did, we'll link to our YouTube channel where you can find the interviews with Dr. Benjamin Schlechter as well as Dr. NJ Flores. As always, we love hearing feedback. Please email us at hello@orionpodcast.com. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you. Thank you. Take care. And we really honed in on the solid organs because they're often the most common. That's a lie. They're not the most common. Fatigue and the other ones are. Start over. And we really hold in on, hold in. It's like, why? Hone. And, okay. Start over.
Which each of these organs, we will touch on the symptoms.
Do you want to start the beginning of that again?
Which each, with each
yeah,
of these.
Yeah, I was like, did you say which or which?
Oh, did I say which? My bad.
The best New Year's deals are happening now at Tanger Outlets. Celebrate with up to 70% off savings from Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. From activewear to accessories, beauty, and apparel, find everything you're looking for to kickstart the new year. The clock is ticking. Hurry into Tanger Outlets to save more. Hundreds of brands, unbeatable value. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.